Yes, Honest Actors is back with brand new episodes every Friday. To help me continue releasing new episodes without a sponsor, or to say thanks for your favourite old ones, click the support link in the episode description. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. It's a one-off, feeling generous, good deed for the day sort of thing. Think of it as bumping into me and buying me a drink. To find out more, click the support link. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
Yeah, mine's a large red.
I hate those guys.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, and you're on time.
My name is Adrian Lester, and you're listening to the Honest Actors podcast.
Hi, my name's Jonathan Harden, and you're listening to episode 2 of the Honest Actors podcast, series 3, sponsored by TodayTix. If you want great offers on theatre tickets, access Today seats on your mobile, and exclusive front row lotteries, you need TodayTix. The ticketing app that lets you see theatre differently. To get tickets with no queues and no fuss, download TodayTix now from the Apple Store and from Google Play. Boom. Before I let you hear this interview, though, I'm going to ask a few things of you, which should come as no surprise. If you've already heard episode 1 with Kate Fleetwood, they're exactly the same things. Please go onto social media and share your favourite moments from the past 3 seasons with the hashtag #BestOfHonestActors. Please also, if you're feeling particularly full of the joys of the season, leave a lovely rating and a generous review on iTunes or wherever it is that you get your podcasts, if such things are possible. I'd also ask you to tell your family and friends orally, if you don't mind, because those things still matter. So please, please, please do tell people that the podcast is back. I think that's it, really. Do I have anything else to ask? Nah, here it is. This is episode 2 with Adrian Lester. Just before I let you hear it, I should say this was recorded way back in October of 2017, but 3 days after I talked to Kate, as it happens. Again, this was done at Adrian's home address, and I have to admit that it's one of the few moments in the podcast when I've been a little bit, starstruck's the wrong word, a little bit kind of pinching myself as someone who watched Adrian on television growing up, and growing up, I guess, when I was an adult. But I watched him on TV, and then all of a sudden, by the virtue of this podcast, find myself knocking on his front door. And then, even more bizarre, a man that looks remarkably like Adrian Lester off the TV answers. So I took me a little while to settle into this one. I should apologise for there's a little bit of sweater noise on the microphone. It's Adrian's microphone. And I wasn't wearing headphones for this one. Got cocky. Regretted it, never did it again. So I wasn't aware of some of the issues with the sound as it was recording. I've cleaned it up a bit, I think, but it may still be not up to the usual standard, so apologies for that. This is a cracking interview, I think. Adrian was a cracking interviewee, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Here it is, episode 2 with the wonderful Adrian Lester. Enjoy.
Where did it all begin? I was nine. I joined a cathedral choir in Birmingham, where I was born and raised, and I started singing treble in that choir. So I sang lots of masses, you know, Mozart and Haydn and Bach and stuff, and then I joined the Children's Opera Company at Midlands Arts Centre in Birmingham, and I did 2 performances with them just before my voice broke. But one of the performances I did, a guy from the choir linked me to the Children's Opera Company. And when I was in there, one of the performances I did, we did an opera called Dragon Tales of Granny Chang.
I don't mean to laugh. It's a great title.
It's in terms of casting, it was ahead of its time. So there I was singing opera at Midlands Arts Centre, and didn't have a real taste for opera. But what fascinated me was the youth theatre. The director had got members of the youth theatre to come along and do sort of dumb show for all these stories we were singing, us kids singing stories. And I remember singing and just taking my eye off the conductor and being fascinated by what the youth theatre were doing. And staring at them as they were sort of bringing to life from nothing, right. Just bringing to life all these stories. I thought, that's amazing. And then I joined the youth theatre. And that was it. I was kind
of... So what age are you then?
I was 14 when I joined the youth theatre. And then I was just hooked. Every summer, plays, wrote and directed a play when I was 16, was determined to go to drama school. And, you know, so it just carried on from there.
And was it a family push to go into the singing? Was that, did that come from the family? Was it a religious thing, or was it just a sing? Did the family sing?
There was a real appreciation of music in the family, as I've found across the board, really, with my family, every household. But it was just me when I was younger. I used to love copying Michael Jackson's dance moves and singing and glued to the television, Top of the Pops and all that. And then I just went for the audition. And at school as well, I was always at primary school, I was always singing a lot.
So there's no resistance, I guess, from the family to the singing.
No,
but
no.
Was there any resistance to the kind of more
to the acting bit? Not really. Once I started working, I did a lot of walk-on work for Central Television in Birmingham in the summer, sort of when I was 14 and 15 and 16. And I did a radio play with Rudolph Walker, Carla Monroe and Tony Armatrading when I was 15, and I got paid for it, like properly paid. And so to be 15 years old and being paid through your summer, that was my summer job, and then paid to work for the BBC at Pebble Mill. You know, for my mom, it was just, my dad wasn't around, but for my mom, it was kind of, it just sort of made sense. And then I was getting, the youth theatre got reviewed in the papers properly. And so, you know, I got mentioned in reviews and positively. And so for her, it just seemed like, well, this isn't silly. You're getting paid. Obviously your peers are saying that you can do this. I enjoy what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she just sort of went, she encouraged it. And I came down and auditioned for drama school.
Just because it's raised it. I mean, in terms of being 15 in Birmingham, it's a fairly multicultural city. Was there ever a sense that being a black actor at that age, that was going to become an issue later on? Was there ever a feeling, a concern, if there was one, that maybe that was going to be the thing that might prevent you going further with this?
You know, I never gave any thought to how limited other people would view my opportunities until in hindsight, really. I, when I left drama school and I walked out into the world and thought, right, I'm going to work. You know, I was 20 and it was... 1989, and I was coming out, and then I had to really start thinking politically about the business. And I did the world. When I looked around, then I thought, my God, this is not going to be easy. This is hard. There was no one that I could see doing what I felt I could do.
Because you have become one of those actors in a way where you've become a role model. In a way for young black British actors, because it is achievable. You can work at the highest level in theatre and on screen. And I suppose there's a lot more role models now, certainly, definitely,
yeah,
than there were when you came out of drama school, and even more so than you were 15.
Definitely.
Did you have, you know, I mean, I don't want to reduce everything down to race, but did you have a black British actor role models when you were younger?
Well, working with Carmen Monroe and Rudolph Walker and Tony Armatrading, I mean, I knew those guys from television and admired and respected them. And so there was that. And Lenny Henry, albeit at that time, he wasn't acting particularly, but he was definitely...
And he was Birmingham, wasn't he?
He was Birmingham.
Yeah, of course.
Definitely cutting a path on Tiswas and so on. Just being multi-talented as presenter, as comedian, as you know, raconteur, and then also as an interviewer, when he interviewed people, he always kept the bubble going, and he was just really, really good with people and performing. And so there were those kind of things going on, but mainly for the heavy dramatic stuff, it came from America, those influences, those kind of role models. And you know, I left drama school and just thought, wow, there's I didn't look at the work that everyone expected me to do. I kept an eye on the work that I really wanted to do.
Which was,
I suppose, and he's stayed with me ever since, really. Every job I do, I suppose I just want that job to make me a better actor. So that's the only criteria for choosing work for me.
That's great.
It's just, am I going to be better at doing my job after this?
Or worse.
Or worse, you know? And sometimes you can be in a job and feel yourself shrinking as you go, oh my God, they want me to what? And that's when I get to this cutoff point and I go, no, I can't do this anymore.
That's great.
It's
a wonderful way to make decisions. So perfect, almost perfect segue, as good as you're certainly going to get on this podcast. In terms of the jobs then that have helped you become a better actor, which ones stand out? So it's a slightly different question to what I normally ask, but just because I think of what you've said, and no one's ever said that before, I'm interested to find out what were the huge learning curves in your career, if one or two stand out.
The massive learning curves. Working with Declan Donnellan, with Cheek by Jowl, and doing As You Like It, playing Rosalind in As You Like It, that whole kind of 2-year, 18-month experience, because we did it twice, that was like my fourth year of drama school in a funny way. Declan and I got on like a house on fire, which it was a brilliant sort of, you know, addition to the job. And then the rehearsal process and the freedom and the experimenting and the... It was a real eye opener, a real lesson. And then working with Peter Brook doing Hamlet, that again was another one of those.
That would be able to throw things like that in. It's not bad, is it?
It's not bad, but yeah, that whole process was brilliant, and yeah, it was fantastic. And doing Company with Sam Mendes playing Bobby, that physically, vocally, emotionally, and physically with the dancing, that's probably the most demanding job I've ever done. 8 shows a week. That one probably was.
What was your first pay? So I come out of drama school. What was your first paid job? Where did it begin?
My first paid job, I played a political prisoner in Pretoria prison, in a play called Hanging the President by Michele. Oh, he was sort of an Italian writer. It was amazing. But he wrote this play, and it was directed by Ian Brown at Traverse Theatre Edinburgh, and it was part of the festival. And he wrote this play, and I had basically no lines. I only had one. I had to sing Nkosi Sikelele Africa, African national anthem. But the premise was, it was a four-hander. Premise was that two white inmates, one of them was the sort of head of the gang in the Pretoria prison, were going to be hung in the morning, and so was I. 3 condemned men. And I'm put in their cell. They're both narrow-minded, you know, absolutely racist, Afrikaans racist. And I'm put in their cell, and I haven't spoken. I've been tortured. I'm a political prisoner. I haven't spoken. So I'm a member of the MK, Mkhonto Wesizwe, the sort of military wing of the ANC. And I've been thrown in this prison. And I haven't spoken. I haven't broken under torture. I'm going to be hung in the morning. And I'm put in this cell. And the wife, the weaker of the two men, is told if he can get me to talk, he'll get a reprieve. He won't get hung. But the other one has been told, you just have to put up with it. The prison's crowded. There's 3 of you in the cell. He's going, oh, my last night on earth, I got to spend my time with a geffer. You know, that was the thing.
Yeah.
But the play was, I remember it being intense. Mandela was still in jail. You know, it was intense. And I did so much with silence because the play was written.
Yeah.
I just had to look, and this guy's desperately trying to get me to talk. And one of them's insulting me. And I was just completely silent. And in the end, I sang this anthem.
There's huge power in that as well, isn't it?
Huge power in it. But that was a learning curve. That was a massive learning curve. And I thought, oh, I've got no lines.
And you never thought that again?
Never, ever thought that again. You know, that kind of, what's the it's now become apocryphal. There are no small parts, just small actors. But I didn't have a word on the page apart from this one song. So, you know, vocally, I just sort of I could shout all night and drink and have a laugh in Scotland. Because yeah. I didn't have to protect my vocal cords for the next performance. But yeah, it was good. That was my first play. And my second one with Bridget Panning, who was a teacher at RADA, it was an education job for the National Theatre. And we went round the country and teaching A-level students about Shakespeare. And I spent 2 hours in the morning with them going over the iambic pentameter and pronunciation and rhythm and clause and subclause and all that. And then in the afternoon, we did a potted version of Midsummer Night's Dream for an hour with five actors. So I played Puck and Lysander. And that,
hold
again,
on, that doesn't work.
I know, massive learning curve. But there were moments where I was lying on the, I had this jacket on and I was lying on the floor and a jacket and a t-shirt and I had to go to sleep as Lysander, then leave the jacket on the floor, get up and be Puck, and put the poison in the thing in my eyes, then lie down as Lysander, having the poison go in the eyes, and then get up and speak. And it was great. She directed it brilliantly, but that was a huge learning curve.
That's thinking back of all these jobs, man.
Yeah,
that's
great.
So, you know, it's fair to say at that point that no one knows who Adrian Lester is at that point, you know, in terms of the general populace.
Not, I hadn't done anything that had sort of broken that thing.
Do you think you had a big break? Do you think can you put down where you are today to one thing, or do you feel like it was more a succession of little things?
A succession of little things, really. And also, if I turn up at a theatre for say, an opening night, people will... The audience might recognize me for certain things. That's all to do with theatre.
Yeah.
And they're all different things. Walking down the road, people are going to go, "Oi, Mickey," you know, because of Hustle. Yeah. But then because that's been gone for so long now, what's nice, people go, "Oh, when's it going to come back? You can do it again." But now it's because of Undercover, which I did with Sofia Canedo. So there's a bit of that. And that changes the way the thing you're known for changes the way people approach you.
Okay.
Which is, you know, one of the things with the public, because you're in the television, you're in the room.
Because Mickey's approachable, right?
Mickey's approachable, but Mickey has kind of status, and Mickey's always three steps ahead of you.
Okay.
And people kind of approach you like that.
Right.
They approach you with that kind of, don't want to get in your way, but they approach you with that kind of thing. Whereas,
am I Mark?
Yeah, am I Mark now? Am I ruining something? But then there's also that feeling that, and I reckon if I'd been on television playing a sort of, "Oh, laugh at me, it's great fun, we're just having a laugh, I'm a, you know, low status, ooh, he's just a bit of a clown kind of person, and a great job and everything," but I imagine people would approach me in a different way.
Yeah,
I've got to get the door.
No, clip yourself.
Buy tickets to the best theatre in London the new way. With the TodayTix app, getting great offers and access to exclusive tickets has never been easier. With TodayTix Rush, you won't have to queue at the box office for hours to get day seats like some pauper. And you can access big savings with their lotteries. I'm going to open my app here and give you some bits of, you know, samples of what's available. There are tickets from £15 for A Very, Very Dark Matter. Sorry, Martin. A Very, Very, Very Dark Matter. The Inheritance from £15. True West from £18. Tom Hiddleston in Betrayal. Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. Lots of good stuff. Get on there. Download TodayTix, the theatre ticket app from the App Store and Google Play to see theatre differently, but still with your eyes.
Yeah, so you were talking about people approaching in and, you know, the nature of...
Yeah, for different things. And then when people approach for Undercover, because I got to do on television in Undercover... the stuff that I'd only ever done on stage, emotionally and the complexity of character. So the fact that I got to do that on television has changed how some people approach me, not recognizing me from that show. Because you can actually feel a different, a sort of weight of if you like, respect or a sort of, it's more complex. It's not sort of just fun.
Yeah.
And people approach you in that way. Like, "Oh, you're a proper actor." One person actually said to me, "I didn't know you were a proper actor." after doing Undercover compared to Hustle, which, you know, can be slightly insulting, but actually, no, great, fine, great. So yeah. That's nice.
Does it ever become tiresome? Does it ever, I mean, they say walking, getting recognized walking down the street, it's for one thing or the other, but it does that thing become tiresome? Does that very fact that walking down the street, I imagine it's fairly likely in certain parts of the country as well, where they don't expect to see people off the telly, that when you're away working, for example, does that become a bit, oh, I can't be bothered going out?
No, it's never become, I can't be bothered going out. I get stopped in Sainsbury's, or people will nudge my arm and go, oh, hi. And I see people recognizing me and not saying anything. And then other people just go past. So it's not like, I'm not at that, you know, level of recognition. I'm not like someone, I'm not on EastEnders, yeah. You know what I mean? Or Coronation Street. I'm not at that level. I pop up occasionally. And so it's never become tiresome. I always go out with a baseball cap. And what's weird is I've worn a baseball cap since I was 14, 15, the hip hop era and the dancing and the whole thing. We just wore baseball caps. I just have baseball caps. I have loads of them. But I do go out and I have my cap on and I found, oh, that helps a little bit. But people have come up to me and gone, hey, does it work? Does it work? does what work? You know, I see you're hiding. I'm not hiding. I've just got my cap on.
So taking it back then, I suppose, to the kind of processes that we all share, because I guess the kind of the being recognised kind of end of it is affects less of a percentage of the people who do the job than it doesn't. So the things we all share, like auditioning to a certain degree, or you know, when you get calls and all that kind of stuff. Do you enjoy auditions?
No. No way.
Definitely not.
Definitely not. No.
Like, would you ever get to the point where you say if something was offered to you, you'd think I'd rather meet and have a chat about it? And it's not an audition as such, but you ever think like, I want to put myself through a hoop or put them through a hoop? Or
I do. What's great about the internet now, and I came out and worked and there wasn't an internet, and now there is, and I've, you know, been working through the birth of it, and now it's become a household thing, is that you can always check a lot of people out.
Yeah. Who is this?
See their work and so on. Yeah, it's great to get the job, but actually I'd rather have a supporting role in something that's brilliant than, you know, grab that lead role with a director who's actually rubbish and the vision is not good and no one knows what they're doing and all of that, because then what's the point? Because your face is on screen, you carry the job. So it says, you know, I didn't like that last thing he was in it. That last job, he wasn't good in that. Mm. And actually, the whole thing was shit.
Yeah.
I prefer to be part of something brilliant, but playing a supporting role. The sort of offer subject to a meeting is the nice one.
It's the ideal.
That's the ideal. That's kind of, it's basically yours, but they want to meet and just chat. Because then you're just checking out that you're not arseholes.
Yeah, everybody, there's an arsehole check. There's a gate.
There is. There's a gate, just to make sure that you're not an idiot who needs certain colour flowers in your room and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
But the auditioning thing, pure going in, reading, hey, nice to meet you, show us that you can string a sentence together and you can act thing, I never liked.
Have you got better at it? Worse at it?
I've got better at it because through directing stuff and having been in the room while people are auditioning as the director, I've got better at auditions.
So what has that other side of it taught you?
Well, it's kind of, it showed me that actually when you walk into a room, and I've said this to students, but the understanding that the casting director is actually working to show the director that they can get good people in the room.
And they want to show how good you are.
They want me to be good because they want to say, listen, my reputation goes on this. Then the director, as they start working with you, is going to show the producer how good they are at working with actors. And the producer might be thinking, this person's just done this. And it's not about you. It's about this person's just done a BBC show where they had a high level of men between the ages of 15 and 30 watching the show. So we want that audience also to come in to watch this show. Yeah. So that comes with this actor. So you have to be good with this actor. So if I walk in and go, okay, I just got a couple of questions about the script, then the director's going, I fucking better know what I'm talking about because the producer wants me to. And it rolls like that. Then you've got the exec who probably doesn't give a shit and is just saying, hurry up because it's costing me money, this room. Yeah. Once I broke down, actually, there's not just one wall of people who just, you know, are sitting there going, I don't think you're very good. People are actually working in the room trying to want you to be good for varying different reasons.
Mm, interesting. Do you know when they've gone well? Like, because some people say the opposite. Some people say, I think it's gone well, I get it. I think it's gone brilliantly, I never do.
I do know when it's gone well, but then you don't hear anything for a while. And that's because maybe it's gone off to the number one choice, who's a very slim chat possibility for them.
But the execs had them go.
They had the one choice.
I think you should still ask.
Yeah. You have the one choice.
Meryl Streep.
or Adrian Lester, you know, because we are completely interchangeable.
That's how it works.
That's how it works. But and they go for the number one choice, and the number one choice is faffing around thinking, oh, I might not. And so you're just left hanging as a second choice. But and I've come down to being, you know, part of the three top or the two tops, and just constantly never got the job. But I've become one of the ones that people will get in for a certain type of role. And I think, well, great, okay. At least I'm kind of
there. Or thereabouts, as they say.
Or thereabouts. I was talking to one casting director, and this is interesting to know, and I met him from America, Paramount, and I met him in London. And I'd worked for Paramount, done a supporting role in a comedy show for them. And I started talking about my love of martial arts, and he said, oh, would you mind if I get that on camera? And he held up his iPad. And I just started talking about the style and what I like about it and all that. He said, oh, that's good to have. And I thought, where does that go? Yeah. And he went, oh, I put it into the casting bank at the studio. And I went, what are you casting bank? What do you mean? And he told me, which is of course makes sense, that when you audition, you put yourself on tape, you audition for a part for the major studios. I think they all do this now. It's worth checking. But they put your name, of course, goes into, you know, they take the file.
Yeah, it's all digital.
It goes into a bank.
And they put a little few flags on it, like,
exactly.
You know, martial arts,
yeah.
Great.
That. So when they've got a role coming up and they thought, oh, what about this actor, Adrian Lester?
Hill.
They can put the name into the bank and up will come every audition I've done for that studio. So they can watch all of them and see what I'm like. And you suddenly go, fuck. So I've realised that when you go to audition, and you put on camera.
Oh, that is terrifying,
no,
Adrian.
But it's great.
It's great, but it's terrifying.
It's terrifying because it means you're not just auditioning for that job. You're also auditioning for anything else they might have over the next 3 or 4 years in that audition. So
it's terrifying. It's brilliant, but it's terrifying. And I wish I'd known it 5 years ago. So thank you. It's better that I found out today than 5 years from now.
Yeah,
but
so
still,
now
all my auditions are
Rolodex
going. All the ones where I went, do you know what? I'm never going to get this and I don't have time to prepare.
And I sod it.
Fuck. I probably should have just not turned up, is the thing.
And the other thing, and I know we're going to move on, but the other thing about that is that I was talking to a casting director and she said all the good directors that she works with, they always come in and watch. We flag the actors that we think are good. They always come in and watch the takes of the actors that we think are good, even if the actor hasn't got the role and they've given it to somebody else, because they then take all the ideas that have come from the other actors playing it.
Of course.
Because you'll get some amazing French actor, you'll get some amazing British actor. Then when the American actor's on set playing the role, the director's got a suitcase full of great ideas that came from all the
options. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
And hands them to the actor playing the role. So actually, if you come up with a good idea and do a good audition, you're actually helping the guy who's get us the job be better.
Yeah, because we need that.
Because we do need
that. Because that's helpful when you're unemployed. Yeah,
that's fantastic. Yeah,
that guy who's getting paid also got my ideas. he's doing my version of it, but only he's getting paid. The other side of it, do you still get excited? Have you got less excited over time when you get a job? I mean, I imagine the first time you got a job, that job at Edinburgh, coming out of drama school, that was a fairly exciting moment.
My agent, she has mentioned that I'm kind of strange that way. I go to the next level. If I get the script, I'm like, oh, that's really good. Okay, what work do I have to do? I will do the work. I go in the room, I do the work. Then I walk away. Oh, you've got to the next stage. I go, right, that's great. So what work do I have to do? What do I have to do now? Oh, there's some new scenes. Right, fine. It's always the next thing.
Right.
And then she goes, they want you to do the role. I go, great, that's fantastic. Okay, so I didn't get the accent right, so I have to do some work on that. And I have to do some research on police in that area. Okay, that's fantastic. So when do they want to shoot? They want to do this. Okay, what work do I have to do at home to make that work with the kids? And I just go on to the next thing. And she said, are you going to sort of
celebrate
at any point? Or just go, yay? And I go, oh, yeah, no, of course, yay. Great, yay. But
do you celebrate? Like, do you, like, say, you know...
When I finished a job.
But she would never, like, you know, your wife comes in and you've been talking about it the night before and you say, I got it. And there's, like, a moment of, and is there discussion of, shall we open a bottle? Like, does that kind of celebration ever happen?
But with the stuff that we're trying to get off the ground now, which is more film, me directing and my wife has written, if that happens, there'll be like a 4 or 5 day celebration. actually, we do it when the job's over. We sort of have that kind of, yay, fantastic, I got a role, you know, and that's great, great director, great place, wonderful, great part. But when the job is finished, the last night is over, then we sort of go, and that normally comes with that.
Yeah, of course.
Yay.
But then, I mean, the thing is, I suppose that's good because it kind of softens the edge of the beginning of possible unemployment. You know, you kind of, you start unemployment with a celebration.
Yes.
Yay, I'm unemployed.
But I find that you do all your real work when you're unemployed. That's when you do all your real work.
What's the longest, I mean, in that entire period from drama school on, what's the longest you've gone without meaningful work?
That was a good lesson, actually. I was unemployed for a year, solidly, with no voiceovers, no TV, no nothing. And that was after I'd done what was arguably my biggest break, which is Primary Colors. And I went to America and did that film, had an amazing time, learned loads, came home and it, you know, could have been my agent then or not, but I came home and I thought, right, I'm not going to audition to play the sort of minor supporting role in a theatre piece after doing Primary Colour, playing the lead in an American film. I have got to get some kind of television.
Yeah.
And I waited and waited and waited and waited and waited and nothing came along. And I went and met people and I auditioned and told them about what I've been doing. Nothing. And it's one of those moments, there's been about 3 moments in my career where I thought, well, sod this, I'm going to America. And toward the end of that, I thought, sod this, I'm going to America. And then Lenny James, the actor, had written a piece called Storm Damage and the BBC had finally said, yes, we'll do it. And we started shooting that. And that was a year after I'd done Primary Colours. So that was the longest I've been on the point.
So when that comes along, that time, do you say, if you thought 3 times about, I'm going to go to America, is there ever, I'm going to do something else?
No, never.
Has there ever even momentarily been a kind of a, when you were younger, for example, thinking maybe it's not too late for me. I could do something. I could be a singer. I could, you know, I could go and teach martial arts. Or
they've always been a sort of as well as acting.
Do you read reviews?
Yeah.
At the time that you're doing a show?
Yeah.
How do you feel that changes, or does it change what you're doing?
It always changes it for the better, because if I don't agree with a reviewer, I can just cancel it and just forget about it. If I have little faith in the show and I don't like what we've all done and I don't really like what the audience are getting, then I'll steer clear of reviews. But normally, I will read them as a way of, did they see anything that can be improved? And sometimes with some really good reviewers,
they do.
They pick up on something that I think, you know what? I remember mentioning that in the first week of rehearsal and I forgot about it. And then I'll just shift, change, tweak something.
On a similar note to reading reviews, have you ever Googled yourself?
Yeah.
And have you ever come across anything that again has changed how you feel about yourself as an actor, or is that stuff less important?
That stuff is really much less important. But I have done that because when walking into companies now and saying, oh, yes, this film, and yes, I could play that part and here's the story. And I know that they'll go away and they'll Google me.
They'll Google you. So you need to know what they know.
Yeah, I kind of Google myself and think, what's popping up? What's there? Also, I live quite a, you know, Lilita and I have been together for 30 years now. And so we live quite a straightforward, boring, I suppose, life. We're not falling out of clubs at 2 a.m.
Yeah, yeah.
In the arms of someone else, drunk. Yeah. You know, we're not, you know, doing all sorts of crap. And so that's kind of us. We're kind of fairly straightforward. And I know that we're kind of boring, really. We're not really newspaper fodder.
Which is great.
But I do occasionally Google myself just to see how I'm seen, I suppose.
Yeah. You said your career spanned, I suppose, the kind of the arrival of and the growth of the internet.
Mm.
Has that changed? Not a bit, but beyond just Googling people before you go and meet them, has that changed the industry, do you think?
Yeah.
What changes have you seen in the industry that related to that and otherwise? Like, I mean, in that 30 years, I guess, since entering it.
The visual, the way we can watch content, how many screens we have, and the access to content has just jumped through the roof. It's just become incredible. And the rise of the YouTube stars and the fact that people, you know, we can spend all our time concentrating on character and motivation and lines and script and all of that. but actually, you see people watching it on the train, checking their stop and just laughing every four lines and looking at a certain moment. And you don't have to have a beginning, middle and end. You can just have a punchline, and that punchline will go around the world much more than any program you've spent millions on for the BBC. And the three people involved in doing that one punchline can make a show out of just doing punchlines. You know, next week we're going to just try and do it with a big water balloon. And this stuff, I'm watching this stuff open mouth going,
That doesn't change. That doesn't make you any less inclined to think about character. And, you know,
it doesn't make you any less inclined. But you can see that in order to grab the attention, viewing figures have gone right down.
Yeah.
Because everyone's watching so many other things. Which means that the amount of money advertisers pay to pay alongside shows has gone right down because
people are watching. Yeah.
So therefore, the money that goes into the shows goes right down. So you can feel that happening. And unless you get something, I mean, it's great that you get things like a Netflix and an Amazon and Hulu and so on, because then it pushes the TV thing back up, and HBO. It pushes the quality of production right back up.
It's interesting you talked about not being newspaper fodder, and that one of the things I think that's moved on that I have observed in my, you know, say 15 years doing it, is that people have become more concerned with their public image. People who have no real need to be concerned about their public image are concerned about their public. So agents are, as somebody told me recently, somebody who works a lot told me their agent had a workshop for some of the actors to come in and learn how to use Twitter and all this kind of stuff, and things that make me kind of cringe, but I kind of, it's the American model of, like, you know, the publicist and all that stuff. Is that something that you, I guess you do a lot of publicity for projects, but you as an individual, is that something you've ever chased? Have you ever been kind of concerned about, you know, being at events, or do you think those things are important? Do you think it's important to show up at things, selected things? Obviously not everything.
I mean, maybe it is, but I don't do that. I think that if you have to have some sense of anonymity, because people have to, I'm not a TV star or film star, so I don't get paid to play different versions of myself. Same accent, same mannerisms, same place of birth, same, that's not me. That's not the kind of actor I am. A lot of people do. So if they can take that persona, you know, you get the tin of beans and what you see on the tin is what you get inside. They can take that persona and put it everywhere and go, oh, you know what? I like that persona. I like that guy. And they can have that thing. Whereas for me, that's not really good, because
you can play the tin of beans in my movie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, I really should have chosen a different product on a supermarket shelf. But you, what you see is what you get. And what some people don't like is that when they see this thing, they go, well, that's actor. They go, well, what am I going to get in that? I don't know what I'm going to get. What's he going to be? I don't know what he's going to be good or bad or accent or what.
I like where you've gone with this.
Do you know what I mean? I don't know what I'm going to get. So therefore, sticking that product all over the place won't do you any good. Because you're not a personality, you're not a persona. Because when you do a job, you're completely different.
Yeah.
And I like that. And so therefore I don't try to do that. I do Twitter because I found that I really like the fact that people can ask me direct questions and I can answer them directly. And it's not filtered through any publicist or anything like that. It's me. And I'll do that sometimes in the morning and I'll just chat to people.
Someone said to me it was good because they realized that it put their actual unedited voice back into things.
Yeah.
And that they were in control. So if something was being misreported, that they had a means by which to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Their version of events.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the better.
And when I've done that, when I've actually had to answer someone and say, actually, you did this in interview, the effect has been really powerful. And so I don't say anything unless I have to. If I think that there's something that people who follow me might be interested in, I'll point to it. But apart from that, it's not a soapbox. It's just... I can actually have a conversation sometimes with people who are a student who's studying drama in Leicester and is thinking, well, what should I do now? And they ask me a question and I can answer.
It is becoming increasingly important, though, for certain types of work. So, for example, I've been in rooms, I used to work in a PR company when I wasn't acting, where the conversation on the other end of the phone has gone when they're booking someone for an event. So, like, the kind of actor usually who does soaps or whatever, he also makes a sideline income from... open and cutting a ribbon at a supermarket, right? But slightly more higher level than that, like giving an award out at a Virgin Short Film Awards or whatever. And the conversation has gone, okay, are they available? No. Okay, who else have you got? Okay. How many Twitter followers do they have? Because they don't know who the person is, but the only qualifier they need is... what's their social clout? You know what I mean? Like, what's their kind of... And there is, I think, a generation of actors now, below certainly both of us, who think that if they can get enough Twitter followers and if they can pay a publicist for a year and be seen at things, then offers will come in, right? And I guess there is there must be a seed of truth in that because it does seem to happen occasionally.
Yeah.
Do you think we're moving towards that kind of an American thing where is perhaps talent becoming less important, do you think? And even amongst the kind of, I didn't know you were a real actor. Like even amongst the jobs for real actors,
uh-huh.
Is anybody you see out there and you think you're just, this is a hollow PR campaign?
Yeah, but I think I've seen that on a couple of people, on a few people, but... maybe it's a hollow PR campaign until they get the right job that shows they can actually do
Yeah, of course.
But sometimes I've watched people and just thought, you better do something quick because that bubble's going to burst. That bubble is going to burst.
You better not chew up on the loose women table again.
Yeah, for the fifth time. You better come out in something quick because actually you're showing that you have more sort of... you're courting public awareness.
Of nothing.
Yeah. It's not based on anything.
He's not working. What do we know him for?
Yeah.
So then to kind of quickly, bring that round somewhere else, how important is talent? If it's not, say, PR, say the other thing is luck. Right, so talent and luck are the two poles, right? Whereabouts do you think, which is more important?
The talent is more important. Definitely, because no matter how lucky you are, I mean, as a brilliant actor, James Earl Jones said, he said that he's always found that the harder you work, the luckier you seem to get. And he works hard. But being on stage with him, man, the man just is amazing. Luck will... maybe get you in the room or get you the job. Once you get the job, you have to execute it.
Yeah.
There always comes a point of execution, and luck doesn't play a part in execution. Maybe you're lucky because something happens in the public arena that links to your job that you've just done, and then everyone goes, "Oh, did you see that film about the da da da?" Maybe, but you still have to have execution.
Have you been lucky? That said, to get you to the point of execution,
I don't think so. Things that have happened seemingly out of the blue, like even getting Hustle, right? I thought, I had to audition for that.
And also, you were in Henry V.
I wasn't Henry V at the time. But getting that from the TV, oh, you want to cast the theatre actor? That's what you get.
Yeah.
But even getting that, I remember having a conversation with Jane Featherstone, who's now running a different company, but was the producer on that. And I did say to her, well, you know, your third series in, I just said, how did you find, you know, because producers don't go to the theatre. I said, somebody dragged me to the theatre, and this was, must have been 5 years before, to see a musical at the Donmar Warehouse. And I went, oh, really? I said, and it was Company. He said, and I saw you in Company, and I always thought, oh, I want to try and get something to work with that guy, because it's been great. So when Hustle came up and I heard you were auditioning, I thought, great. And so that was the thing.
You never really know. That's the thing. You never know what a job might lead to.
But I worked my ass off for Company.
Of course.
Which led to what could be perceived as being, oh, you just got lucky and got that job. But actually, the two things are connected.
Have you been unlucky? Have you ever sat in those moments when you're not working and it's grey outside and thought, if I'd have got that.
All the time.
Do you find it hard to watch things you haven't got? Like if something comes on TV or you turn a page in a magazine and it's that film that you auditioned for and some other lucky guy's got it and he's at the point of execution and beyond and you're sitting here, do you ever think, if only?
All the time. Yeah. But that's part and parcel of actually wanting the job. If you want it, then you're going to be disappointed about not getting it. And then I have this thing where I have watched people do things that I've auditioned for and I've watched them do it and thought, there's no way I could have done that.
That's brilliant. That's great though.
That is good.
I don't find that discouraging. I find that, because what you don't want is to watch something and think,
I've had that one too.
That guy's awful.
I've had that too. Where I've just thought, they've missed this.
I think, he's better than me. I'm terrible.
I've watched things where I've auditioned for and I've looked at the execution of it and I've just thought that because of what the actor is, either they're older or they've just got a longer career, weightier, they're more powerful. I think, well, actually, you know, great, but I don't have that weight on screen.
You couldn't do that. There's nothing better.
I couldn't.
Because it lets you off the hook.
Yeah, I just couldn't do that. Yeah. I just couldn't do that.
Do you get jealous of friends? So those are people that you might not know. If you ever, and I qualify this as I have done, I did for the other day in the interview, I said, I get jealous sometimes of people who I'm not even competing with. So it could be Meryl Streep, you know, it could be the opportunity.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not necessarily the person, but the opportunity. Do you get jealous of friends?
No, not jealous. I envy the position sometimes. And I think what they're doing is brilliant. But you know, then it becomes a life thing because I have to put the whole package in, and I'm at home. I waved goodbye to both my kids this morning. I'll be here just about when they come back, and then I'll go and teach a class. My wife's here. We live in a lovely place. Everyone's healthy. You know, there's this whole thing that comes with it. And when I look at the circumstances of other actors, I see, yeah, I envy that. I really envy that. But that person can pack a bag and disappear for 6 months and, you know, they don't have the responsibilities. They don't have those things. So, yeah,
cheers.
That's mine.
So, yeah, we're just talking about jealousy taking hold. Are you competitive then?
With myself, yeah. With myself. That thing I said to you before, I always want to improve. And I don't want to tread water. And I will sometimes take a step sideways, but I have to step forward. And I always give myself a real kicking if I don't.
This is a bit of a sidestep in an interview, in that it's pretty much a non sequitur. But it's just kind of struck me as a question. Well, first of all, have you been more conscious? Actually, let's take it back of things. Looking back, you said earlier, we talked about race and about being a young black actor coming out of drama school and looking around and realizing for the first time that this might, you know, lead to us both. And then you talked about glass ceiling, that this might actually, there might be a glass ceiling. Are you still aware of things being more difficult for you because of the fact that you're a black actor? So when you look around at contemporaries that aren't, Do you feel like you have, in some ways, been held back because of that?
I'm never in the room when I don't get the job, and I'm never in the room when someone says, actually, we don't want to see him for this role. But in the years that I've been working, I can look around and see many more faces that represent the rest of the planet at work in Britain.
Or even the rest of the country.
Even the rest of the living country. I can see many more faces at work in Britain. So that's changed. And speaking with Lenny Henry and Marcus Ryder and Pat Young and Barbara Emile and talking about, you know, Ofcom and talking about how things need to change. At first, when complaints were raised, we as a group of media artists were told, oh, there's no problem. What do you mean there's a problem? Of course there's no problem. Well, there's that person's working there, that person's working there. Of course there's no problem. Then the problem was raised again. And it was just sour grapes because, you know, of course you just haven't got that job. You didn't get that job. You're kind of thinking, oh my God, there's no problem. Then the problem was raised again, but this time people had left the country and gone to America and had got their talent, had actually shoved them up higher.
Yeah.
In America than they would in Britain. So that was an example of what was wrong, that shone a light. And there are amazing white actors, male, female, up and down the country, who do not get the opportunities that they should. Absolutely, absolutely true. But those actors can stand up and look around and see people like themselves doing the amazing roles. So there's a kind of reflection as in, oh, okay, I haven't been seen by the right people, or I haven't been lucky enough. So there's an opportunity there. But when you're working hard and you look around and don't see anybody like yourself, then you think there's something wrong here. So there has to be something wrong with the picture. So once the complaint was made again, and the example of actors going to America and saying they've done really well over there, there is something wrong with our industry. Lenny Henry stood up and said something at the Sony Awards, and the papers went for him. And rather than back down, Lenny then came back with figures. He doubled down and went, look at the figures. These are the figures. It's not me. It's not sour grapes. These are the figures. And suddenly the newspapers went, oh, ooh, industry. What have you got to say about that then? Yeah. And suddenly the industry went, oh, well, at first there's no problem. You're being silly. Then there's a problem, but we're doing something about it. Now there's, oh shit, there's a problem. So the recent push of casting now, there's lots. I mean, I can feel opportunities knocking on my door now. I'm thinking, these doors were closed before.
All of a sudden, it's like,
all of a sudden, I'm thinking, these doors were closed. My knuckles are raw from banging on these doors. And now they're going, we'd like to have lunch. And I'm thinking, shit. So that's changed. But now we're trying to make sure that let's not go back to that situation ever again. Let's always make sure that a certain percentage of what's out there is always balanced.
And let's make sure the opportunities at the other end of the scale as well. And it's not
completely,
just, you know,
it's not just black. It's disability. It's female. We're actually getting fed up of being told, actually, you're just this kind of character. And as long as your character influences the lead man, then you're fine. And we're thinking, no, it's time to actually reflect the country as it is.
Yeah, well, I'm starting. Well, is it a documentary? No, right.
And
the people.
That's your starting point.
That's your point. The people that you want to pay to see it, where are they?
As long as you know, that's fine. So just very quickly moving it on then. We've had a chat about lots of things that we'd have chatted about anyway, so it's great. Have you ever been aware of a job changing you? So getting back to that kind of sense of growing or changing or learning as an actor, as a human being, has playing a part ever altered you for good or for bad, temporarily or permanently?
Yeah, it's the cliche, actually, playing Hamlet did, but then also working with Peter did. So the whole experience changed me completely. Doing Hustle did, taught me a lot.
Do you think you would be a different, and this is, you never ask this question categorically because it's a what if kind of version of events. Would you be a different person I mean, had you not had the experiences you've had as an actor, so some of the older actors I've spoken to, I mean, much older actors have talked about how being an actor makes them, they find it very hard to categorically believe one thing because they're trained to constantly question or empathize with people who disagree with them. And so they become less strong in their opinions as they get older. They become, which is actually against what most people will tell you, but old age psychologists will tell you, the older you get, the more set in your ways you get. And the older actors I've spoken to have said, no, they find it very difficult because they're always thinking, but why does this person believe this? And, you know, that kind of thing. Do you feel that? Or
I do feel that, but I kind of... only in terms of having an empathic response to their point of view, but not believing as they do. I still hold my opinions rigorously, but because I can see their point of view, it means my opinions are even stronger, I feel, because I can shake them. I always attack my own opinions from a different point of view. And so, I do. I really empathize with a lot of people, and even when I'm listening to things on talk radio or LBC or, you know, I listen to it and I think, this is the most obnoxious person I've ever heard, but actually I can see the structure of their argument.
Yeah.
And so rather than get on a sort of left-wing high horse and go, but that's just wrong, I actually think, oh, but you can break it down here.
We're in the kind of almost rapid fire now. Is being an actor hard? Artistically, practically, financially, which one is more than any other?
Practically, financially, it has been, and touch wood, through that period. It was around the point we bought this house. And artistically, it depends what you do. It depends what you say yes to. You only have one power, that's to say no. That's your only power. You can't say, yes, I'll do that job. You can't. You have to be offered it. The only power you have is, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go for that audition.
Do you consider yourself an artist?
At times.
Depends on the job.
Depends on the job. Depends what I'm working on. Most of the time, I think I'm just a problem solver. Most of the time, I'm just problem solving. You're clearing stuff out of the way, making stuff make sense.
Interesting. Do you consider yourself successful?
Yes, all things considered. And for me, a strong part of that is the relationship, the kids, the home setup. I think I'm really enjoying this period of success.
How would your 20-year-old self evaluate where you've got to?
My 20-year-old self would... I sometimes come home and remember me at 21, 22, visiting older actors who were really established and really well known. And it would be like walking into this place and seeing them settled. And
that's gratifying.
That's gratifying. I sort of go, oh my God, I've become that thing.
Well, I turned up earlier and I had that feeling. I was like looking at the house in the front thinking, yeah, I mean, this is you're at one of those, and we'll never, you know what I mean?
You just go, well, yeah. And sometimes because...
Unfortunately, though, I'm not 21.
But there's the counselor, there's these parts of me. There's the counselor state kid who went skateboarding to go to the Midlands Arts Centre and used the rooms because he couldn't afford to pay for them, to dance, to sing, to do his own thing, break dance and practice moves, and then go home again and do a little bit of homework before going to school in the morning. And that kid still lives here because I'm just still that kid. I'm still that kid who was on that counselor state. And I hope to God I will never forget that.
You just went very Brummy there in the past 20 seconds. As you were talking about that.
The psychotherapist will now just...
It just went...
It heavily came in. Yeah, it's a real thing. And it's in the back of my head. And it's not a chip. It's not a thing. It's not a whatever. It's just to look how far, you know, grandfather to mother, mother then to me from Birmingham on. There's a straight line. And I just look how far... it's come to this.
To
never forget that. And I try to remind my kids of that, although I tell them you won't feel it. Because what was for me a council estate on a balcony and a little bike that didn't have a chain that I used to go down the road and play with my mates, that's my 12, 13, 14. But for you, it's this.
Yeah, for you, it's nice trees.
Yeah, and you have to remember that that is the tree. I said, you have to remember that you're growing up. in what is a sliver of the 1% in this country. And that's just a fact. And you have to just walk with that and know that. It's not your fault.
And not apologize for it.
No, absolutely. It's not your fault, but just know it. Yeah, just know it. And they go, yes.
You have gifted your children middle-class guilt.
Yeah. And I remind them, I give them it with breakfast.
Left-wing, middle-class guilt.
I give it to them with breakfast. So, never had milk when I was young.
See, I already answered how you define success. I'll ask you if you could go back and offer your younger self advice, and you've offered lots of advice today, largely about, you know, the stuff like you can only say, the only power you have to say no, about always wanting to learn from a job, and that's the kind of main deciding factor for you. But if you were to go back to that 21, 22-year-old and offer him some advice about not so much how to get here, but maybe to avoid some of the sidesteps along the way, or maybe the sidesteps were useful. This is, so I don't want to kind of, in a way, end game your answer. What kind of advice would you give specifically to him?
I suppose whenever I do these chats with students, what I say to them is what I would have said to myself when I was younger, because you're full of insecurity. You just got this big barrel of insecurity. And actually, you can only be good externally or in a job or appear good on stage or appear good in something or appear good with people by going inside. By going quietly inside. Because if you watch somebody's performance on screen and you say, well, could I do that? Yeah, you could. You can copy it because you got the voice and the presence and the rhythm, and you can absolutely copy that. The thing is, when faced with the rehearsal room or the set and the blank, the script and blank stage, would you come up with that? And the thought to come up with that is only something that happens right inside. So I would just keep saying, concentrate on inside. Concentrate on your on what you think is weak about you. If you don't have a very good singing voice, but you go, no, that doesn't matter. Matter. It matters. Work it. If you think, I love it all, but I'm not quite good with movement and my hips a bit stiff, work it. Work that problem out. Because somewhere, somehow, you'll be doing something where you're in a field or you have to do a sword fight with someone, and that'll hold you back. So just always go inside, find your weakness, and work it until it's not a weakness anymore. And what's weird is that for me, from where I'm from, which I've already talked about, Shakespeare and classical theatre of that level was a massive weakness. Didn't do it at school, didn't do it in youth theatre, did one play at RADA, which wasn't a full play, it was a sort of workshop thing, and left RADA knowing about Shakespeare and knowing the nuts and bolts, but not having done it. And I thought, you have really got to learn to do this. And what's ironic now is that part of my persona is that I'm a
Shakespearean actor.
Shakespearean actor.
Shakespearean actor, Adrian Lester. I didn't know you were a proper actor.
Not many people do.
So then, what makes you angry in the industry? There's an answer, just and it's just it's inside your head.
It's the ego attached to some people that will, and it gives the whole thing a bad name, but that will pull a whole production off course just because that ego needs to be served. And this is producer, director, actor. This is, I mean, some of the egos in the industry. Every job, be it stage theater, be it theater or TV or film, it's this delicate balance of all these bits working together seamlessly, and one ego in the middle of that destroys it.
Have you ever felt yourself like, oh, maybe I'm becoming an ego? Because sometimes I have felt like when I feel like I'm being principled over something.
Whenever
sometimes
you're making a stand,
I feel like, is this a stand? Or am I on the other side of this? Is everybody in the production office going, whoa, he's demanding? And then you have to kind of work it backwards and go, no, I'm in the right here. I'm in the right.
Yeah.
Do you ever fear that, you ever have those moments where you think, Adrian, is this ego or is this?
Yeah, sometimes I've thought that. But then you still have to turn up and execute. And I think that if if you've demanded, asked for certain things, and you said, look, I think this, I think this, I think this, and actually, I need this, 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 then however it's given, when you turn up, if you fucking execute and you are an addition, a positive addition to the company and the crew and everything like that, then actually, you've just asked for what you needed. So I think Evian bottles of water that I demand in my contract are actually fine.
Yeah, really?
That was a joke, by the way.
No, I don't see that that was. I think Evian water, I mean, that doesn't matter. That's not the worst of it. Like, I mean, if that's the level of Davidum, then you don't know Davidum. If you were in charge for a day, if I made you King Prince Adrian V, and you were in charge for a day, and you had a to-do list in the morning, as I'm sure you do many mornings, what kind of things would be at the top of that list?
At the top of that list would be having a very big conversation about Brexit. With all the people in charge. It'd be a big conversation.
We need to sit down. We need to talk about Brexit.
Let's just sit down and talk about this.
That's going to take most of your day, in fairness.
Find Cameron, get his ass here. We're going to have a chat.
We're going to have a chat. And Boris, you can come in too.
You can come in too. Boris is not going to be good. I'll just let you know that straight away.
That would take your whole day, and that would be a day well spent.
That would be a day.
I'm not going to ask you for any more beyond that. Second last question. Do you worry more about health, money, or secure, or work, career? So,
money is career and security. So they go hand in hand. And I'm always planning the next thing. Self-employed, you can't stop planning what might happen if. So I've always kind of, I've always sort of spent. Always spent half of what I've got. Always. And no matter how much I've got, I've always spent half of it, a little bit. If I had to, I spent half, don't spend any more. Just that's it. I've never got anything on HP apart from the house. Never. Even buying the car, when we wanted the car, just wait 3 years, 4 years, just wait. And then it's like that. And people don't expect that. Garages don't expect that. I'm anal like that. It's kind of weird. I will not. I'll pay for it in one go so that I pay the price and not the price times a half.
Plus, yeah.
They ain't doing it. But I do worry about health as I've got older, which is why I think this is sort of this golden period at the moment, because parents for both of us are fine. My wife has lost her mother and I've lost my dad. But remaining parents are fine. All other relatives are fine, were fine. Kids are fine. So I've just sort of sitting in this moment.
You're old enough to have a career and be stable.
And be stable and yet be a dad. So I'm looking at this point now, I'm just going, this is cool, but I am aware of health for other people and for what might go wrong. And I'm just sort of thinking ahead to that.
Last question. Are you in anything at the minute? Past tense, Adrian.
Oh, in it at the minute. Okay, yeah. I'm not on stage at the minute.
I love this because actors automatically go to
because he hasn't.
Because people asking you, and you go to, you basically start. I've just done this. I've just done the thing, and then I'm about to do this thing.
Right. At the minute, Josie Rourke is doing Mary Queen of Scots, and I'm in that.
Thank you very much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure. I think there's loads of stuff people in there are gonna listen to and think that's some genuine wisdom right there. That's some hard-earned wisdom. So thank you.
If there's wisdom in there, that's fantastic. We want that. Keep that and cut the rest.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's it. That is episode 2 of the podcast, Done and Dusted. There is no episode 3 today, but keep an ear out. It may be here sooner than you think. # Best of Honest Actors. Rate and review. Tell everyone. Speak to you soon.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer.
Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.